Few. There is a seasonal practice that is carried on as a tradition every autumn in America. It's when the White House draws the collective gaze for millions and millions of the news channel viewers. This is a spectacle that is carefully prepped and staged, and it's all so that the figurehead for the military-industrial complex might for a moment be softened and humanized in the eyes of the populace. Of course, the tradition I'm talking about is the official presidential pardon for Thanksgiving turkeys. With a smile and some really corny jokes at the photo op, the president and the first lady grant the nation's mercy to a pair of hand-picked heirloom turkeys, a couple of birds with names like peas and carrots, or drumstick and wishbone, or liberty and bell. This little pageant is an effort to put a smiling face on the screeching bird of empire. And the American dream is real for just a few moments with some silly gobbles and pecks. As a hand-groomed pair of honorable turkeys walk free to spend their remaining days at a research farm run by a state school. Of course, this charade completely ignores and distracts from the long lists of a nation's failings. Like, say, for a start, the very real and poor disadvantaged human beings who are unfairly awaiting execution on death row in the most incarcerated nation in history. Not to mention the wealthy who flout the law, a growing economic inequality, a looming environmental crisis, Washington's political buffoonery, so many other global harms committed in the name of the imperial USA. If I could steal a line from a classic 90s television show about a cheerleader who killed vampires, the subtext here is rapidly becoming a text. All four Gospels talk about this similar sort of seasonal pardon that's marked out in our story today. And no, there are no turkeys, but in this scene, there is plenty of layers and subtext. One of the things that the Gospels do so well is present us with the starkness of our human situation, what Frederick Buechner calls our tragic nakedness. The naked human that we try and cover up with such a variety of pursuits and titles and pleasures and substances and experiences and validations and earnings and performances. How many lives do we know that are made up of little pageants that are being staged to avoid or at least numb the subtext? What a cost we bear on ourselves, our relationships, our well-being, the health of our whole planet even. We can be grateful, though, that this exposure is not the whole story, because as Buechner puts it, the Gospels strip us bare in order ultimately to clothe us. In our text a few weeks ago, the embarrassed disciples ran naked into the dark. Jesus' closest friends had abandoned and denied him. And last week, in the middle of the night, Jesus' religious community had seized him with rage and malice, with bribes and favors, trumped up charges. They humiliated him. They brutalized him. And then now here today in Mark 15, Jesus' broader community, the rank and file folks in society around him would have their say, as a frenzied crowd would watch Jesus fall through the cracks of the Roman justice system. Folks had probably skipped breakfast that morning, all so that they could gather and join the spectacle to watch the renowned prophet, bound and bleeding, this famous rabbi, this revolutionary, Jesus of Nazareth. As he was brought to stand trial before Pontius Pilate. And at the start, there wasn't really a lot for them to see, because the brilliant storyteller and the wise teacher, famous for his rhetorical skills, didn't have much to say. Why wouldn't Jesus want to put on his genius for display before such an audience? Show us another brilliant argument, like a courtroom scene from To Kill a Mockingbird or A Few Good Men. Now, I may not be a big city lawyer, but my daddy was a carpenter from Galilee. No. The priests would try again to make something with their accusations, but then Pilate would finally ask, "Are you king of the Jews?" Of course, this was a dangerous, loaded question, what we could call leading the witness to self-incrimination, inviting Jesus to confess treason. And all Jesus says is, "You say so." One vague and very fearful phrase is all we hear from Jesus. And then silence. This short and puzzling answer is astonishing for Pilate, and he asks the same question again, but then nothing from the Galilean. What now? Well, this Passover journey to Jerusalem couldn't be an exciting courtroom drama, then it needed to be something else. They used to joke that Caesar appeased the masses with bread and circuses. But in the Roman province of Judea, Pilate handed out the occasional pardon as a tactic to maintain a semblance of peace. And keeping the peace was no small feat in a notoriously chaotic and rebellious corner of the empire. And so we're told of a tradition of releasing a prisoner at the Passover festival. A fun little treat for the people. A photo op. Hopefully a way to settle everyone down and prevent a riot or even another attempt at an insurrection. And you don't need very much imagination to see the risks associated with this tradition. What sort of prisoner would the prefect put back out on the streets? Hopefully it would be a popular and celebrated, beloved champion of the people. As a calculating politician, Pontius Pilate would look for ways to make strategic hay out of such a spectacle. He had a career to think about, and failure in the eyes of the emperor had terrible consequences, as Pilate would actually find out at the end of his career. Pilate didn't yet know it, but he was at the limits of his political talents. Because maybe there was a time when he thought he understood these people, but not this day. In the eyes of the priests and the religious leaders, an influential man like Jesus of Nazareth was a greater threat than any violent robber or murderer. And thanks to some strategic subterfuge, for this crowd, the miraculous Jesus figure had in the end totally failed them. Where was his revolutionary speech? Why didn't the Galilean make some great gesture or perform a miracle for the Roman occupiers? Why hadn't he ushered in a new kingdom, this thing they'd heard so much about? Apart from what we see in the text, we don't really know much about the man Barabbas. There are some curious conversations about his name, including the strange fact that Barabbas simply translates as son of the father, which you may or may not want to make something of. We're told that he was a murderer, a man with a notorious reputation, who killed someone during an insurrectionist riot. Was Barabbas a sort of Robin Hood figure? Or was he just another vicious opportunist? Was he the wrong man at the right time? Maybe Barabbas was good with crowds, good with punchlines and one-liners and zingers and funny nicknames for all of his enemies. Sometimes, though, no charms or talents are necessary, because a crowd will pick the nastiest character to express their darkest desires. This terrible man becomes a sort of populist figure, a rebellion against so much shabby treatment at the hands of the Romans. And if the crowd couldn't have that strange and miraculous rabbi, then why not take a shot with the violent insurrectionist? Maybe a man like this would incite a real revolution. And the crowd cried out for Barabbas' freedom. And Pilate's back and forth with the crowd, he was surprised. Surprised to find them so ruthless, so bloodthirsty. Shouting for Jesus' death by crucifixion? Rome's most horrific and humiliating execution? And even still, in the end, Pontius Pilate made the political move. An effort to satisfy the crowd, even in their bloodlust, setting free the murderer according to his custom. Handing Jesus over to be crucified and having him brutally flogged for good measure. Jesus walked toward a cross, and Barabbas walked free. A living legend of unfairness and a surprising lucky break. Like one of Jesus' wild kingdom stories, a parable come to life. The man who didn't deserve freedom's walking out the front door while the innocent man carried the weight of that crowd's fury and the empire's indifference. What did this man, Barabbas, do with his newfound freedom? Did he walk a new path, counting every breath as a blessing? Did he greet each sunrise with gratitude? Or did he squander the rest of his days? In the next few weeks in Mark 14 and 15, in the last few weeks in Mark 14 and 15, everyone has been implicated and laid bare. There's no escaping the subtext. The nearest disciples and friends, those in positions of power, religious folks and politicians, and all the rest, the masses, the crowd, just standing and pressed together, people making compromises and picking sides and covering our butts, frustrated, making our way, whatever that looks like, sometimes shouting at the screen as our structures and our leaders fail and betray and disappoint us. Other times we feel like maybe we still get away with it, at least for a little while longer, grabbing what we can while we have a chance. But a lot of us really are just holding on. Wherever we find ourselves in this story, we've all been left wanting. As we behold Christ standing silent before such accusations and expectations. In the weeks of Lent, these traditions and practices invite us to let down our guard and stand in our stark and naked humanity. And we will keep reflecting a little longer before Easter's arrival, in rooms with friends like this, in private prayers and whispers, encouraged because the gospel strips us bare in order to ultimately clothe us. And with that insight, we keep the ritual, holding our gaze on the frail and mortal parts, that we might expose our whole selves to the mercy of Christ, who laid himself bare for us. Amen.